From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Myrna Loy was one of the great talents of Hollywood's golden age. Best remembered today as Nora to William Powell's Nick in the Thin Man series, Myrna Loy had a long and varied career. In fact, she made something like 50 movies before the first Thin Man picture. Emily W. Leiter is my guest. She's written biographies of Mae West and Rudolph Valentino and has written a thorough biography of the actress known as The Perfect Wife. The book is called Myrna Loy, The Only Good Girl in Hollywood. Emily Leiter, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Glad to be here.
You know, maybe Myrna Loy is not as well remembered as some of her contemporaries like Garbo or Betty Davis or Joan Crawford or Alison Skipworth. Why do you think that is?
Well, there's more than one reason, but the main one is that being a star was not Myrna Loy's reason for existing. You know, she really cared about a lot of other things more, especially during the latter part of her life. And another reason is that it's related to the first. At the peak of her fame, right at the beginning of World War II, she totally stopped working for a while. She was trying to recover from a devastating divorce, the dissolution of her first marriage to Arthur Hornblow Jr., a producer, and on the rebound from that relationship and from the hurt of the divorce, she left Hollywood and she escaped to New York City and she married a man who was mentally ill. He was the wife of the founder of Hertz Car Rental and Yellow Cab, so the son was very wealthy, but he was really disturbed and violent. So that was a terrible decision on her part. But at the time she decided to take the leap into her second marriage, she also decided to quit working. And she never quite recovered from that, because to be a star, you have to keep at it. You have to keep that engine revved up, because there's always someone else coming along. And stars like Betty Davis and Joan Crawford and Katharine Hepburn just never quit. And you could argue that someone like Joan Crawford, who was very, very talented and also was a friend of Myrna Loy's, by the way, that without stardom, there's no Joan Crawford. And she really didn't have a lot of other resources. Myrna did, in the latter part of her life. After World War II, she became very involved with UNESCO and with fighting for the existence and the support of the United Nations. And she cared more about that than she did about being a star. She really did. So she had an unusual ability to see beyond Hollywood, and that's not always appreciated in Hollywood.
Well, I now want to hear more about her later years, but let's roll back and look at her early years first. I mean, she was often in the early days cast as like a scary China girl or some vamp from another world. What how did she get typecast as?
Well, it's kind of fluky, really. Because Myrna Loy was from Montana. Her father had a cattle ranch. She spent the first years of her life on a ranch. She probably could ride a horse before she could walk. And so she was not this urban sophisticate that you think of as Nora Charles.
Oh, did she never did a Western, did she?
The closest she came to that was the Red Pony, the Steinbeck story.
Right, yeah. But she was wearing a dress.
But how she became typed as an Asian. In the silent era, which is when Myrna got started, there was a lot of typecasting. I mean, there still is some, but there was more then. So once she got her first Asian role, she kept getting them, as she was at Warner Brothers at that time. And as you probably know, Hollywood was really racist, and many villainous parts were cast as Asian roles. So if you were Asian, you were very likely going to be either comic or evil, or maybe both. So Myrna really didn't have a lot of choice. Daryl Zanuck, who started out as a screenwriter at Warner's but quickly became the head of production, couldn't see her as anything but an Asian vixen or an exotic vixen. And he later regretted that as one of the worst calls of his professional career. I mean, he was a very clever, hard-driving guy. But he didn't get that Myrna could do all these other things. And he fired her from Warner Brothers right at the dawn of the talkie era. And that was a blow to her, but it was a blow from which she recovered. But even after she signed at MGM, which is quite a plum, she still was at the beginning cast as an evil Asian.
I'm sure that that's an MGM picture that's with Boris Karloff, the Mask of Fu Manchu.
Yes, the Mask of Fu Manchu, which is... I love that picture.
At
it, but I also find it very painful.
It's a great picture. It's a classic. You can't put that
on. it's classic, and it's over the top, and both Myrna Loy and Boris Karloff realized that in order to get through the experience of making this film, they had to exaggerate how evil they were. And so they just camped it up and had a glorious time.
Did they enjoy each other's company, Myrna Loy and Boris Karloff?
I think they did, although I don't know that they ever saw much of each other after making this one movie together. But yeah, I think they had a ball working together. As you know, because you've read my book, Myrna was a famously easy partner. She specialized in being an excellent screen partner to her male lead. So I don't think there's a single male actor she played opposite who ever had less than a glowing report about what it was like to work with her.
Now, the picture, and that's in color, and Rin Tin Tin introduces her, and she's singing with Nick Lucas, and she's all, isn't it? I love that. That's an MGM picture also, isn't it, where she's doing an Asian
No,
thing?
That's a Warner Brothers.
That's a crazy one. That's another little Asian musical number that she does.
Yes. Yeah, she's quite delightful in it.
And now this brings up an interesting thing.
That's called Show of Shows.
Show of Shows, right. An early talkie. You can see, she's quite sexy in that she's wearing this little kimono outfit. And I was once having this conversation with my grandfather years ago. And he was born in 1909. So I guess he had a different view of... And I was looking at Myrna Loy as an actress from a long time ago. And we were talking about actors and actresses that we liked. And I said, I love Myrna Loy. And he said, oh, Myrna Loy, she had big fat ankles.
old Hollywood. You know, if you're not perfect, then kill yourself.
I laughed about that, but then I laughed again because in your book you do mention her ankles. What was the story with her ankles? Her ankles look fine to me.
I mean, she didn't have great legs. So, shoot me, you know. She had great legs, but she had great everything else. She had a great face. She had a great talent. She had a beautiful body, trained to be a dancer. She had thick ankles. Okay. Take it away.
So, was it Irving Thalberg then who finally saw her as a great talent?
Well, Irving Thalberg gets... points for signing her up for an MGM contract, and Louis B. Mayer also was a party to that. And in the Thalberg era, MGM made a lot of great movies, and some of them were Myrna Loy movies. She also appeared, you know, they worked so much. They made so many movies in a single year. They could barely see straight. So not every movie that she made, even under Thalberg, is worth remembering. There's a lot of filler. You know, they churned them out. It was an assembly line.
Yeah, a movie factory.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Emily Leiter, and her new book is called Myrna Loy, The Only Good Girl in Hollywood. So was W.S. Van Dyne then he was the director of the Thin Man movies. Was he the first one to really find Myrna Loy's character on screen?
Van Dyke gets credit for fighting for Myrna when nobody else was doing that. He directed her in Penthouse, which you probably haven't seen. I mean, it's an obscure early MGM movie, early talkie, 1933. Myrna was funny in it. She had a hard time proving that she could do funny, but she was great at doing funny. And Van Dyke saw that she could do funny in that movie, and he fought for her to be Nora in The Thin Man. And we know that that was very good for MGM and very good for Myrna Loy's career.
Well, The Thin Man, I mean, everybody loves those Thin Man movies, even the ones that, as you point out in the book, they kind of get a little tired.
Yes.
Toward the end. But The Thin Man, the first Thin Man movie, that's one of the great...
It's a great movie.
And she's beautiful in it and funny, and she makes funny faces.
Yeah, and she's so natural. That was one of her sterling traits, that even though she was quite perfectionistic, it never feels like she's straining. It always seems relaxed, and that's a great gift, and she had it.
She has a marvelous quality on screen, and, you know, I've heard about Greta Garbo, who was around at the same time, that Garbo, if you were, you know, even on the set watching Garbo, you couldn't see it. You had to watch it in a movie theater to really see the magic of Greta Garbo. What about Myrna Loy? Was she, what kind of a, you know, how was it in person? Did everybody have a lot of respect for her on the set? Could you see what she was doing? Did she have a lot of technique?
I think Myrna Loy was a very well-liked person her whole life. And by the way, her real name was Myrna Williams. Loy came with the exotic temptress spit. She was easy to like. She was not narcissistic. She was not selfish. She was not greedy. I'm telling you all the things she wasn't. She was good-humored, genuinely. She was fun. She was spontaneous. What's not to like?
Well, what about technically as an actress? Was she a technician as an actress?
I think that she really got to be excellent craftsperson, outstanding. But she didn't start out that way. She went into movies having done no stage acting, which is quite unusual. I mean, Claudette Colbert had been on the stage. Katharine Hepburn had been on the stage. It was very common. Joan Blondell had been on the stage. It was very common to go from Broadway to Hollywood. And Myrna had never even set foot in New York City until after the success of The Thin Man. So her only stage experience had been high school productions in Venice High School, Southern California, and being a dancer. And classes that she had taken, but that was it. So when she got signed at Warner Brothers in 1925, she didn't know how to act. She, she knew from nothing. She had an instinct for being a performer, which I find fascinating because she was an extremely shy young woman, very tongue-tied. And many people who were people from the press who were assigned to interview her regarded that as a task from hell, because you'd ask her a question and she'd give a one-syllable or one-sentence answer, and then she clammed up. So she was not an easy interview, and she never would talk about her personal life to anybody from the press. Her view was, it's none of your business. And she stuck by that, was once voted the most uncooperative actress in Hollywood, because she wouldn't spill any beans about her sex life, her married life, her friendships, her family, none of that. She just wouldn't go there. But she was famous for her ability to be a partner. She did have competitive feelings for many other actresses, which surprised me because it didn't go with all the other things I've been talking about. She didn't have a good word for Irene Dunne, for example. She felt competitive with Katharine Hepburn.
She must have been annoyed by... suddenly, I can't remember the actress's name, but, the one who... Louise Reiner, who suddenly came along and won 2 Oscars in a row, one of which for a picture that she was a star.
she never said anything unkind about her, but I'm sure that was very hard. And the culture, not just the culture of Hollywood, but our culture in general, there's a lot of competitiveness, and it's very hard at any stage in life to not resent when someone else succeeds at getting something that you wanted for yourself. And so Myrna once said, when she was quite young, but was coming up in the world of acting on screen, that only men had helped her, which is just not true. She had an agent who helped her, Minna Wallace. And Natasha Rambova, the wife of Rudolph Valentino, was responsible for giving her her first movie role. So that's 2 women who were absolutely essential to furthering Myrna Loy's career. But Myrna once told a reporter in Los Angeles that only men have helped me. So she was thinking about directors like Van Dyke, and there were others like Edward Griffith who had fought for her when the producers wanted somebody else, and they prevailed. So Myrna was very grateful.
Well, we're talking with Emily Leiter, and her new book is a biography of Myrna Loy. And she's also a poet and has written some wonderful biographies of Rudolph Valentino and Mae West. And you do such a beautiful job in this book when you're talking about Myrna Williams, Myrna Loy, as a dancer. You paint this beautiful picture of the Egyptian theater in Hollywood back in the 20s in the silent era. You say the dance prologues that she was a part of were longer than the movie sometimes.
Yes, and to go to the Egyptian theater was a big event if you were lucky enough to live in that neck of the woods. It was like going to the theater. Well, it was going to the theater because there was all this live entertainment preceding the movie. And the tickets were pretty pricey compared to other movie theaters. It cost $2 for a seat at a premiere in the Egyptian. And that was a big deal. And the whole idea of the premiere began there, with stars coming out for the first night in their beautiful gowns, and the press, and at first, before there was television, there was radio. Radio would cover the openings, and Warner Brothers had its own radio station.
To promote the movies.
Warner Brothers, came into sound movies by way of radio, and by way of also recorded soundtracks. the dialogue, I mean, this famous, I don't know if it's really true, that Jack Warner once said, who wants to hear actors talk? but that's a line attributed to him. I mean, Warner's pioneered sound and got rich on pioneering sound movies, such as The Jazz Singer. But sound dialogue was not the point initially. It's not what they was driving for. They were trying to persuade exhibitors, people who ran movie theaters, that they could save a whole lot of money if they used recorded musical accompaniment instead of having to pay for live music, which in the silent era they did. They may not have had a whole orchestra, which they would have had in a place like
the Egyptian.
Grauman's Egyptian mm-hmm. Theater, yeah. But they always at least had a piano player, and you'd have to pay for that.
Yeah. You do talk very sensitively and interestingly about the personal unhappiness in Myrna Loy's life. I mean, she was married four times. One of her husbands she shared with Hedy Lamarr. He was married to Hedy Lamarr, and then he was married to her?
Gene Markey, who was a writer and a very witty, charming guy, and he was also became a producer at 20th Century Fox, produced some Shirley Temple movies, he collected beautiful women. He was married to both.
I collect baseball cards.
That's right. Mm. He was married to Joan Bennett and Hedy Lamarr before being married to Myrna Loy. Not a bad
no, pretty good.
Record.
Who did he marry after Myrna Loy? Did he ever marry again?
He did. He married a woman. Actually, I've never seen a photograph of her, but I don't believe that she was known as a beauty. I could be wrong. Lucille Wright, who was the owner of a famous breeding ground for thoroughbred horses. She bred thoroughbreds in Kentucky, and she was his last wife. Mm-hmm. In addition to collecting beauties, Gene Markey always married women with more money than he had. And
how convenient.
Lucille Wright was very wealthy. And he, you know, Myrna calls him in her autobiography, which, by the way, is a wonderful book, Being and Becoming. I recommend it. If anybody has time to read it, and my book, too, they should. now I can't remember what I was saying.
We were talking about her husbands, and you were talking about Markey.
Oh, Myrna's description of Gene Markey. She calls him a bourbon. That is, you know, as in the monarch family, the European.
Right.
Elite noble family. He had a taste for wealth and the high life and people with, you know, titled nobility. And that was a taste that Myrna didn't particularly appreciate. He was a real snob, and she was not. To her, you were not your title. You were how you lived your life. But Gene Markey was very, very charming and seductive, obviously, because all these beauties fell for him, and he had an affair with Gloria Swanson. He had, he had an affair with Lucille Ball. I mean, these are women of substance, and they all wanted to be with Gene Markey. So he was irresistible, apparently.
So, but he was husband number three out of four for her.
That's correct.
And then she had another unsuccessful marriage. It didn't last that long.
Her fourth marriage was to a diplomat.
Yeah.
She met him when she was overseas on behalf of UNESCO, and she tried living in Washington for several years while she was married to him. This was in the Harry Truman era. And she gave it a go, but her diplomat husband, according to Myrna's friends, wanted a trophy wife. He really didn't want to be married to a working wife who would periodically go make a movie in Hollywood and who always attracted more attention than he did. I mean, if the two of them were in a room together, guess who everyone wanted to be introduced to? It was Myrna Loy, and he found that a challenge, and he really didn't meet it.
Myrna,
so that was heartbreaking to her.
Yeah, yeah, I imagine. And so she really never married again. Was she alone the rest of her
number
life?
After number four, she decided that's it. And I think she had some very happy years when she realized that she was fine by herself. But she said many times that she was raised to think that she couldn't be a complete person without having a husband. And her own father had died when she was only 13 years old. And so I think, you know, there was a gap there. There was an emptiness there. And she tried to find it by finding a partner, looking for a partner who would be both her lover and a kind of father figure. And that didn't happen. It didn't last. I mean, it happened temporarily. And her first marriage to the producer, Arthur Hornblow Jr., was quite happy for a while. And Arthur was a person of substance. And he helped her to become a sophisticated woman, which she wasn't when he met her. I mean, she was a beauty, and she had just native intelligence. But she hadn't even completed high school.
And I think readers will find your book, Myrna Loy, The Only Good Girl in Hollywood, really fascinating when they learn all about her politics and her own intellectual capacity that developed as she grew, and also about some of her great films. I think my two favorite films of hers that you talk about in the book and that I love, The Best Years of Our Lives, made in, I think, 1946.
Yes, that's a great film.
She's so great in it, and your description of it, you know, her performance is so great in that movie that when you described her performance, it made me cry just the way her performance does. And I also,
and she never got nominated for
an Oscar for that. That's crazy. Especially the movie that won so many Academy Awards.
That's right. It won so many, and she wasn't in the running. But the film deserved all the plaudits that it got. I mean, it is a landmark in the history of American movies, and William Wyler's direction was so accomplished, and he had himself been in World War II and had been damaged. His hearing was never the same. He was a bomber pilot, and so he identified with Homer, the character who comes back from the war with two hooks instead of hands.
Mm-hmm.
And he put a lot of himself into that film. And by the way, he really gave Myrna credit for being a marvelous actress, and he was very, very fond of her, as she was of him.
That's a great picture. And I also love, on the other side, the comedy side, I think Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House is such a great one. She makes me laugh so hard in that one.
That's a charming role, although I'm not as fond of that movie as you seem to be. But Cary Grant is hard to resist. I mean, he's hard to resist in almost any comic role, but he made one stinker with Myrna where he was an airplane pilot who becomes blind but continues to fly.
that was
an inadvertent comedy.
I think people should read this book. It's called Myrna Loy, The Only Good Girl in Hollywood. Our time has flown. It's a big old book, and everybody will have a good time reading it. And the author, my guest, Emily W. Leider. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
My pleasure.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. I hope you'll come back and see us again next week for another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. You can also find us on Facebook, and at iTunes you can subscribe to the podcast. From the Bookshelf is aided and abetted by Francis Venegas. Thank you, Francis, for all your hard work. And I want to thank Emily W. Leiter, author of Myrna Loy, The Only Good Girl in Hollywood, for being our guest this week. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. I'll see you next time.